Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the fallout from the Amtrak derailment in Philadelphia that could have been prevented by a speed control system known as PTC, Positive Train Control, and speak with Robert Puentes, a senior fellow with the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program and director of the Metropolitan Infrastructure Initiative. He joins us to discuss the lack of any overall national plan to link rail, air, and road networks, and the desperate need for investment in transportation infrastructure at a time of record low interest rates when money is cheap to borrow. Then we'll examine the fate of the USA Freedom Act in the Senate after an overwhelming vote in the House of 338-88 to end the NSA's bulk collection of data on American citizens. We will speak with a 37-year veteran of the National Security Agency, William Binney, who rose to the rank of Technical Director of the World Geopolitical and Military Analysis and Reporting Group at the NSA, and we'll discuss how the data that has been collected so far is not just metadata, but personal content that violates the First, Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments of the Constitution. Then finally, as the U.S. and the P5+1 move closer to ending Iran's isolation with a nuclear deal, we will look into the assurances against potential missile, maritime, and cyber attacks from Iran that President Obama offered to nervous Saudi Arabian and Gulf State monarchs and princes gathered at Camp David. Iranian-American historian Maziar Behrouz, a professor of history at San Francisco State University, joins us to discuss what the Wahhabis and the Sunni monarchs find most unsettling, the revival of the underdogs in the region, the Shia. And joining us now is Robert Puentes, who's a senior fellow with the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program, where he also directs the program's Metropolitan Infrastructure Initiative. The initiative was established to address the pressing transportation and infrastructure challenges facing cities and suburbs in the United States and abroad. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Puentes.
Thank you very much for having me.
And why is it that we are alone among the advanced nations in not having a modern rail system? And I think it's in the broader context you could ask the broader question about our crumbling infrastructure, because we know our highways and bridges, many are in jeopardy and are past their due dates, if you will, for replacement. So the broader question is about infrastructure in general. And one of the things that just seems so shocking is that at a time of record low interest rates, you would think that this would be a perfect time to make these investments. And, of course, they have the collateral advantage of putting a lot of people back to work.
You're exactly right. With interest rates as low as they are, there's little reason to understand why the municipalities and the states aren't taking advantage of that and using debt to pay for infrastructure across the board. Part of that is that there's still this hangover from the Great Recession. There's a different kind of scrutiny that's being placed in some of the finances. Some cities and places have spent up all of their rainy day funds. And so there's a lot of reasons, I think, why they're not taking advantage of the cheap debt. But the larger issue, I think, is around the system itself and the recognition that we still need to have in this country that pretty much everything that's on the ground, from the highway network to the transit network to the inner city rail, and then other areas as well. But those three is reaching the end of its useful life. And because these things are not made to last in perpetuity, they've got to be fixed. We've got to reinvest in the existing system. We've got to provide technological augmentations to them. And we've got to make sure that it's actually meeting the demands of the 21st century. We built the interstate highway system in the 1950s, and the interstates are finished. We're not building them anymore. The change has to come where we're focused on what's on the ground now and making sure that it's safe and reliable and that it's as efficient as it possibly can be.
And after the Great Recession and the crash of 2008, my memory of you see the highway signs about how the Recovery Act is putting all this money to work on highways. Was any of it targeted for rail?
At the time, it's hard to remember at this point, but we were hemorrhaging jobs at such an alarming rate that the focus was on quote-unquote shovel-ready jobs. That became kind of a household phrase. Everything was shovel-ready because they had to get money out the door quickly. You had to put people back to work, even in the short term, because we were facing these historic crises. So that was the focus. The money went out the door very, very fast, and that went mostly for the mundane kind of upkeep things that we needed to do. You know, the pothole refillings, the bridge repaintings, all that kind of stuff. The rail money was treated differently. They held on to the money, didn't send it out the door right away, but made it competitive and required the states to submit proposals for this $8 billion chunk of money to build out a higher speed rail network. So, I mean, high speed in some places, but augmentations in others. And so that money went out. States applied. They were awarded money competitively. And then it became political, like a lot of these things do. And you had three governors who came in who weren't involved in the initial applications. And they said, well, we don't want this money. And they turned it away in Florida and in Wisconsin and in Ohio. And so it became very political very quickly. There are still, some of that money is still out there. It's going for those kinds of things. It's going for for widening bridges over rivers so that two trains can pass at a time, additional sidings, landscaping or the right-of-way kind of smoothing and acquisition, things like that. So it's actually being used, but going for those kinds of things that we need to go for, which is just making the system be as efficient as it can be.
So in spite of this accident and what it's revealing, and of course one of the great ironies is that within hours of this tragedy, the House voted to cut $251 million from the Amtrak's budget, which is already half of what President Obama, or less than half of what President Obama had asked for. But nevertheless, my understanding is that since 2000, the number of passengers using Amtrak each year has risen by almost a half to more than 30 million.
Yep, I think it dipped a little bit over the last couple of years, but still, it's basically held steady all throughout the recession, which is amazing in a lot of ways. And a lot of that is being driven by the routes in the Northeast Corridor, and then these short distance routes around the country. I mean, the Northeast Corridor is the most efficient and effective of the entire network. It's very, very competitive with other modes of transportation. More people take the train between Washington, D.C., and New York, then fly that distance. The trains are jam-packed. I take it all the time. And it's a very functioning system. It goes from the heart of the city of Washington right into the middle of Manhattan, and it does exactly what I think you want the system to do. In other parts of the country, you have these short-distance routes that are connecting up these major metro areas where there are economic relationships, very, very frequent service. California has a bunch of these. So it actually functions well in those two areas. The challenge that the Amtrak has is these long-distance routes that go literally across the country and span the whole continent of the United States and may not provide the most efficient service in all areas. If you're going through a city at 3 o'clock in the morning once a day, you're not going to be very competitive. And so what we've got to do is to stop treating Amtrak like one big national system, which is completely equal from New York to Cleveland, to rural Arizona. But treat it really as a tale of three systems, which is the Northeast Corridor, which is different from the short-distance routes, which is different from the long-distance routes.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Puentes, who's a senior fellow with the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program, where he also directs the program's Metropolitan Infrastructure Initiative. The initiative was established to address the pressing transportation and infrastructure challenges facing city and suburbs in the United States and abroad. And China is spending about $130 billion a year on its high-speed rail network, which goes across the entire country. And we know that the French and almost all of Europe and the British have very good rail systems with high-speed trains. And, of course, this Japanese famous bullet train. But we have the Acela, and it's popular, but certainly not competitive by international standards, wouldn't you say?
I would. I mean, I think it's fine for what it is here, but it's certainly not anything to the caliber of the German systems or the Japanese systems.
And why is that? I mean, my understanding is it's a lot of it's to do with the infrastructure and the tracks.
It does. I mean, the Amtrak wasn't created in the same way these other systems were created, which was, I mean, if they were you're trying to solve a transportation problem, trying to provide economic growth, and you're going to lay down these tracks here and here, and it's going to have these objectives and these effects. Amtrak is a system that was basically inherited in the 1970s from the collapse of the private rail companies. They got to the point where, because we had built out the interstates, that the rail system was just so uncompetitive and so profit-losing for them that they didn't want it anymore. the federal government had to step in and say, well, there's a public policy reason to keep this going, so we're going to create this new thing called Amtrak, and we're going to provide passenger service. It was basically set up to fail. No one thought that it was going to be able to make money, but it has limped along from year after year after year because in some places it actually does work, and because of political strange political bedfellows that didn't want to lose the service. And so the challenge we have is this is a system, it's a legacy system that has its roots from decades and decades and decades ago. Amtrak only owns the tracks in the Northeast Corridor. It doesn't own them in the rest of the country. Those are owned by the freight rail companies, which have generally had a very good relationship with Amtrak. But now, as the freight rail companies are going through their own tremendous renaissance, moving a lot of energy, for example, there's competition for space on the tracks, and Amtrak can only do so much. So the challenge that we have in this country versus others is that this is really a system that's just been cobbled together from the wreckage of the private railroads. It's not a system that we set out to design in its most optimal way. So in a lot of ways, you can say, well, that's actually remarkable that the system performs as well as it does, given how it was created. But now it's time to, I think, take a hard look at it and to treat it in a way that we do, that we need for the 21st century.
And I imagine when you talk about the freight rail system, for example, that Canadian tar sands oil is now moving. It's been moving for some time, right? On the mm-hmm. So you're suggesting that the freight rail system is squeezing out a lot of the potential for any kind of passenger, certainly long-distance passenger travel.
Well, they were required by law to provide the service, and I think that it's generally been fine. I mean, the trains are still running, but these challenges happen, and if you're going to have a robust freight rail network that's really making a lot of money for the railroad companies now, the passenger track, the passenger service that's on these tracks, is an intrusion in a lot of ways, and you can see their rationale behind that. But we're not going to build any new tracks, right? In a lot of places in this country, we're doing it in California, as you know, with the high speed rail program, but there's not a whole lot of places where there's a lot of new track going in for passenger service. And that's the challenge that we have right now.
But in the broader picture, though, my understanding is that our airline system is pretty much maxed out. We can't really build any more airports, and already you have to line up for a long time on the runways to, it's like a traffic jam at the big airports. And here in Los Angeles, for example, the 405 freeway was expanded, took years and years of inconvenience, and they were only able to squeeze an extra couple of lanes on, and it's back to gridlock. And there's no way there's no place where you can build any more freeways. So My sense is that the automobile and road transportation is maxed out, air transportation is maxed out. All that's left with potential to grow and to serve a growing population is rail.
I think you're exactly right, and I think people forget your last point, that we're not Western Europe. I mean, we are a growing country. We're going to accommodate so many million more residents in the next couple of years. To imagine each of them are going to have cars and are going to drive the same way is crazy. It's just not going to happen that way. But I think because we're experiencing dramatic changes in the way Americans travel, particularly as it relates to driving, particularly as it relates to the younger generation, we don't quite understand it all yet, I think, but we know driver's licensing among the younger generations is as low as it's been in four decades. We know that overall driving is really leveling off. I mean, we used to just drive more and more and more and more every single year. That hasn't been the case for about a decade now, even before the recession. You're right that we're starting, because we're not blowing out these cities and metropolitan areas the same way, how we're getting between them is of critical importance. And rail has demonstrated that when it's efficient and effective, like it is in the Northeast Corridor, like it is in parts of California, it actually can be an enormous benefit to the overall network. Where we haven't done a good job is connecting it to the aviation system, as you were mentioning. We treat these things so separate and so different. We have a Federal Aviation Administration, we have a Railroad Administration, Amtrak is different. We don't really link these things up, and when we deal with something like airport congestion in and around metropolitan New York, which is where most of the air traffic delays in this country originate from, it's amazing that we don't think about, well, what would a rail alternative be? How can we actually augment the rail network so that we can take some of the short haul flights off the books? We don't have to be flying flights from New York to Philadelphia, right? Or these super short flights that could easily be accommodated by train. We've not made that connection because we're too siloed and too fragmented.
Well, I don't mean to give you any more local examples here, but this one is so compelling. We recently expanded the rail system, and it is being expanded in Los Angeles. It's
sure.
now going out to Santa Monica. But it was expanded a while back all the way to the airport, but not to the airport itself. It stops like about a mile or two from the airport on the wrong side of the airport.
Yes.
And my understanding is that the reason this ridiculous thing happened was because of the taxi lobby. You know? So how do you, in order to really have a system that works, you must need a lot of political clout and a lot of focus, right, to be able to sort of corral all these petty interest groups and come up with a real national plan. And my understanding is that the conservatives in this country think that because the government runs Amtrak, that's the problem. Not the problem that you talked about, it that it was a sort of cobbled together out of the sort of carcass of a collapsing system. So you study this issue. How can you get around the – I mean, I know that the taxi lobby example is pervasive, but I think it just shows you how competing political interests can sabotage things.
Yeah, and I think the analogy is also with rail or with intercity rail and with the airlines, where there's – The conspiracy theory is that, well, Southwest Airlines is the one who keeps getting in the way of a lot of the high-speed rail programs in the country because it's the Southwest and it's areas where they would feel like it cuts into their service. I don't know if that's true or not, but there was just recently an article I read about a proposed high-speed rail line from Dallas to Houston, which is a private venture, and it actually looks like it's actually going to happen. And that the story was that Southwest hasn't said anything about it yet. That was the story. So there might be a little bit of truth to that, but the fact still remains that we still don't treat it like an entire system. And the general public doesn't care at all about the different modes the way that the federal and the state bureaucracies do. They think about it all different. You'll get in a car, you'll drive to a train station, you'll hop on an airplane, and it's all just one big system. The fact that it's all completely fragmented is bewildering. And we're really one of the only industrialized countries on the planet that treats it this way. Other countries have their own problems, but they're not as fragmented and as completely disconnected as this country is when it comes to the transportation network.
So what is the answer then? I mean, are we just sort of stuck with the status quo? Obviously, you know, the fact that within hours of this terrible accident in Philadelphia, the Congress cut funds from Amtrak, that's astounding that they were able to do that without some element of shame. But obviously they think that, you know, I don't know what they think. Do you know what they think?
I wish I wouldn't even begin to imagine what they think. I think I'll say, though, that it illustrates the point that change is not coming from Washington. It's not going to happen. But the conversation inside the Beltway in Washington is so different from what's happening outside. It's almost like it's two separate countries. During this week, this we've been traveling around the country. We've been in places like Chicago, also in Philadelphia, but Seattle and Las Vegas and Memphis. And we used to talk to officials on the ground, Republicans, Democrats, left and right, public, private, philanthropic, everybody. There's a very, very different conversation. There's a broad understanding that infrastructure is an important component of the city and metropolitan economies, and they have to have a 21st century network in order to have a 21st century economy. And they're actually acting on it. They're doing different things in these places. They're putting together new innovative finance programs. They're going to the ballot box. You have voters that are approving a referendum to pay for in transportation infrastructure like they've done in Los Angeles and elsewhere. So they're taxing themselves. You have state legislatures that are raising gasoline taxes, red states like Wyoming, blue states like Maryland. You have them working on public-private partnerships, working with the private sector to get some of that money and that kind of expertise in the system. You have the states working together, like this West Coast Infrastructure Exchange between California, Oregon, and Washington. So it's such a different can-do attitude that is happening in the cities and states and the metros across the country that is not reflective of what's going on in Washington. So my hope is that Washington almost takes a pass and stops kind of intruding and then waits for a little bit, and then once they then just starts to react to what the cities and the states and the metros are doing, because that's where the action is happening. The federal government can be helpful in supporting what they're doing, but they're absolutely not going to be leading anytime soon.
So just in closing then, Robert Puentes, what do you think the legacy of this accident will be? given that now we've learned that 8 people have died, 200 have injured. I think almost all are recovering, including those in critical care. Obviously, there are lots of this talk now, of course, of why it is that this PTC thing wasn't ubiquitous across the system. The positive train control, which is an automatic technology that would have prevented this accident, even if they were 106 miles an hour at a 50 mile an hour curve, and if the operator was asleep at the switch or whatever, this system would have kicked in and prevented the accident. My sense is that it'll just be a further black eye for Amtrak, and none of the conversation that we've been having so far is going to resonate.
I think that will be the one outcome. I think that I hope that we'll see some more action on PTC. I think that we know that it's a proven technology. The National Transportation Safety Board has said that it would have prevented or at least mitigated at least 25 fatal train crashes over the last decade. So we know that it works. We've got to step up the effort to get that deployed throughout the system. How that's going to happen, I think, is unclear, but that should be one outcome. The focus on safety has to be absolutely paramount. People shouldn't wonder whether they get onto a train car or into a subway train or into an airplane, whether or not they're putting their lives in danger. So that's got to be one big outcome from this. The other thing I think is, I hope then as we think about the future of rail in this country, that we do start to think about it as these different systems. Not to say that one should be better than the other, but we can't treat it as one giant network when they function so completely differently. We've got to treat the Northeast Corridor different from these short-haul routes and also different from these long-haul routes, and then establish a rational program for running those into the future.
Well, Robert Puentes, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Robert Puentes, who's a senior fellow with the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program, where he also directs the program's Metropolitan Infrastructure Initiative. The initiative was established to address the pressing transportation and infrastructure challenges facing cities and suburbs in the United States and abroad. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into the overwhelming vote in the House to end the NSA's bulk collection of data on American citizens. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is William Binney, who served for 32 years in the National Security Agency and another 4 years in the military component of the NSA for a total of 37 years. He rose to the rank of the Technical Director of the World Geopolitical and Military Analysis and Reporting Group at the National Security Agency. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Binney.
Thank you for having me.
And on Wednesday, the House overwhelmingly approved legislation to end the NSA's bulk collection of data on everybody by the sound of it. And it was a pretty overwhelming vote, 338-88 in favor of the so-called USA Freedom Act. Now, its fate is uncertain in the Senate because of Mitch McConnell, basically saying we shouldn't change the status quo. But I would say with a vote like that, that's got to be a pretty intimidating message to McConnell, wouldn't you say?
Yes, and in fact, it didn't even address the unconstitutional act of doing that. That's basically a violation of the First, Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments. I mean, they talk about metadata, but really, what they're doing is collecting content with that. So it's not just metadata; it's content also. And so that simply means they're violating all the the amendments of the Constitution. In other words, if they want to scrap the Constitution, there's a way to do that. You put a proposal in the Congress, you get it voted on, get it passed, circulate it to the states. If 75% of the states ratify it, then it's an amended. You know, and that's that's the proper procedure for amending the Constitution. You do not do it in secret with secret courts and secret interpretations of laws that nobody else understands. You don't do this in behind closed doors.
Now,
it's a democracy anyway.
So, William Binney, in the recent Second Circuit Court of Appeals decisions striking down the use of Section 215 under the Patriot Act, did that come up, what you just told our listeners, that this is much bigger than metadata? This is really a collection of, well, as you say, it's a violation of a number of important amendments in the Bill of Rights.
Yes, that's right. The idea of content didn't come up. I think they specifically addressed the bulk metadata acquisition. They haven't addressed content yet, but that's coming along with Buell versus NSA. There's another case coming through the courts that needs to get to the Supreme Court, where we need to have this out in the open, where everybody can have their say. I mean, that's what you do in a democracy, right? You have an argument in a third Article III court where you have pros and cons and they're argued back and forth, and it's done in public so that everybody can see it and so that everybody knows what the decisions are and what path we're taking. Right now, we have a secret government in Washington doing secret things behind closed doors. And they knew it was illegal from the beginning, by the way, because they kept it as a covert program and kept a very limited number of people knowledgeable in it, and the rest of them they kept in the dark. So then they had basically an uninformed Congress and an uninformed public, and that's the way they wanted to keep it. And until it was exposed in the New York Times in 2005, that just blew their cover. And so now, after that, there were so many lawsuits coming on as a result of that they had to go and give retroactive immunity for all the crimes the telecom companies were committing, giving them all their data. I mean, it was against the law. They knew that, and they knew it from the beginning.
So,
and this circuit, Second Circuit, is only verifying that was and always has been illegal.
So that's to say then, William Binney, that James Risen's revelations in the New York Times were key. Now, do you think they went after him and Jeffrey Sterling because they were mad at the bigger issue?
Oh, of course, yes. I mean, it's retribution all the way. I mean, they target virtually all journalists anyway. I mean, the idea is they want to know who you're talking, what kind of articles you're going to be writing, whether or not it's going to be embarrassing to them, and they need to be able to prepare for it. And if you're getting information from insiders through a whistleblower or something like that, they need to find out who that is so they can take them off the street. That's been their modus operandi from the very beginning.
But clearly, James Risen's revelations were key. But I thought also that didn't Edward Snowden also reveal a lot of information about this program?
Yes, of course, yeah. And, he brought out documentation that was irrefutable by the government. So now it was evidence that could be taken into court. And so now they can't deny it. So, by the way, one of the best sources of all this information that's been published as a result of the Snowden leaks is on a NSA.gov site. So once it gets published in public, they're putting it out as a consolidated website of their own. So NSA is basically admitting that now all this information is unclassified. Well, if you looked at Executive Order 13526, Section 1.7, which is, of course, the executive order governing classification for all the agencies in the U.S. government, it says you cannot classify material if it is, first of all, evidence of a crime or evidence of embarrassment to a person or an agency, or for any, and there's a number of other reasons, but those are the main ones. Well, most of the stuff that in terms of domestic spying is evidence of a crime. That can't be classified. And it says in that section, it says you must declassify that so it could be admitted in court. And that's the whole point of it. That's why these people in Washington who vote for these issues and do these kinds of things all the way up to the White House need to be indicted.
And again, I'm speaking with William Binney, who served for 32 years in the National Security Agency and another 4 years in the military component of the NSA for a total of 37 years. He rose to the rank of the Technical Director of the World Geopolitical and Military Analysis and Reporting Group at the National Security Agency. So I'm just astounded, though, that you're telling us and our listeners, William Binney, that the best sort of digest of all of these issues relating to bulk collection is actually now on the NSA's website?
Yes, yeah. All the material that came from Snowden that's been published in either The Guardian or, you know, Der Spiegel or anywhere in the world, why they put a consolidated list of all that on the NSA.gov website.
So who's going to lobby in support of Mitch McConnell to see if the Senate can try and stop this? And
well, certainly not me. I've been a registered Republican for about 50 years, and I'm really sick at what the Republicans are doing with privacy in the United States and the violations of the Constitution. In fact, the way it's going, I'm not going to vote for any of these bozos. I'm going to try to work to get them fired. So, I mean, that's what they deserve. First, they need to be fired. Then they need to be indicted for what they're doing.
So, and you're talking about the Rubios and the McConnells.
Everybody that supports this surveillance, mass surveillance, yes.
Right. But the House vote surely is encouraging for you, isn't it? I mean,
Yes, it's just, this is evidence of the fact that a lot of members of the House they didn't understand what the surveillance was going on, and only now, after the evidence came out from Snowden, do they have some factual basis to make decisions. Before that, they were kept in the dark. And so now this is a reaction in the House, I think, for the members who were lied to by the White House, by the intelligence committees, by the agencies that were involved, and by the Department of Justice. I mean, everybody's saying this is legal. Well, it's not legal. It never has been and never will be. Even if they pass a law to try to make it legal, it's still not constitutional. That means that law is not a law. Unless that law conforms to the Constitution, it's not a law.
So I'm absolutely flabbergasted, though, that there's a possibility that this whole Jeffrey Sterling case over Operation Merlin might well just be sort of small potatoes punishment for the fact that the NSA is really mad at James Risen of the New York Times for first revealing this secret program. And once the cat was out of the bag, it was then buttressed later by revelations from Edward Snowden. And you're pretty sure that they just were looking for a way to punish him.
Oh, sure. They did that to me, too. I mean, they tried to do that to me. They fabricated evidence and submitted it prepared an indictment against us with fabricated evidence. The only reason I'm not in jail is because I caught them at it. And I told them that I was going to charge them with the malicious prosecution if we went to court. And so they dropped everything because they knew I had the evidence to show that they were doing that. So, yeah, they're a very hateful group. It's a very controlling the power, money, and control are the issues for them in Washington. Instead of working for the people of the United States, they're working for themselves and for their associated companies. This is really getting to be more like a fascist state where the industry is working hand in hand with the U.S. government.
And these are these
vast founding fathers were really afraid of.
Right. So these are these vast private companies that have been outsourced, like the one that Edward Snowden worked for, right?
Yes, that's right. I mean, it's like, for example, in the intelligence community alone, they spent since 9/11 at least $1 trillion. Now, that doesn't count the defense. I mean, that defense budget has to be much more than that, you know, probably close to $8 trillion. So that's a lot of money, and there's a lot of investment in this. A lot of people are working in high-paid jobs and so on. A lot of people were made millionaires because of this.
Right. Well, I think Booz Hamilton is in turn owned by the Carlyle Group, which is the ultimate insiders in Washington, right?
It's an incestuous relationship, yeah.
Right. And what did they come after you for? Because my understanding is that you had tried to alert the public to an amazing boondoggle, like $8 billion is being wasted on some ridiculous program that was never going to work, and they were going to pour more and more good money after bad. And
which is what they did, yeah.
So just walk us through that in a brief summary, can you, just so that people know about your history?
Well, it had to deal with back in the 90s, 1997 was basically when we started. The problem back then was there was too much data for analysts to get through, so they were buried under data and couldn't find and couldn't succeed at trying to analyze their targets. So that was the major problem back then. And so I was kind of chairing or heading a group to try to work a process that would solve that problem for the analysts, would only present them with a rich environment of information for them to analyze that would be relevant to their targets. So we did that. We made that working back in the 90s, but it didn't cost a lot of money because we did it in-house, and it was all pretty cheap for us to do and take care of, and it didn't support a large budget and so on, which is what General Hayden, then the director, wanted to do. So his program was Trailblazer, and when Alexander came in, he created, instead of Trailblazer, he changed it and substituted a new one, called it Turbulence or something like that. So they had a set of programs running that were going to cost a lot of money, and they were outsourcing it to the companies, and the companies were going to manage that for them. So you see how the companies were moving into the intelligence business and taking it over, basically, so that they're really inseparable from NSA now.
Well, but it sounds to me like what you're telling us about, you're telling us about the genesis of this whole situation that now has come to light with bulk collection. In other words, you're gathering a big haystack out of the ether, and you're looking for the needle in the haystack, and then you come up with a cheaper and simpler way to find the needle in that haystack. But instead, because of the boondoggles, they want to pour more hay on and more hay on. Instead of finding a magnet to find the needle, they're just pouring more and more hay on. And that's what this bulk collection was all about, as far as I can tell. Just a huge amount of hay to add to this haystack.
Yes, and here's the underlying focus that they had. It was a way to build an empire, because after all, this is an ever increasing set of hay year after year. It's doubling every couple of years, all the data being passed. So that means you have an ever increasing amount of data to collect. That's an ever increasing budget to make that happen. And so that's what they saw, and that's what they were leveraging, and that's what the intelligence community, NSA, CIA, FBI are using right now. And when they collected everything, so they're really good at forensics. That is, after the fact, going in and finding, because they've captured all the data, they can go in and find all the relevant information against the person who they now know did a crime. Well, that's a police job. That's not an intelligence job. You know, the intelligence job is to tell in advance, predict in advance, intentions and capabilities of potential adversaries, so that you know in advance when the attack is happening. Take, for example, the shooting down in Texas just last week. That shooting was tipped off. The police down there were tipped by anonymous 2 days before the attack that something was going to happen down there. And what did our intelligence community say to them? Nothing. I mean, here is anonymous who were focusing on a given issue, finding information that was related to an impending attack, and they tipped people, which is what the intelligence community is supposed to do. And our intelligence community was asleep. Why? Because they've got orders of magnitude more data than they had in the 90s, and it's ever increasing year after year with the concept of bulk acquisition and bulk collection. I mean, that just buries them all in this information. They can't find anything relevant anymore.
So was that an anonymous tipster, or was it the group Anonymous?
It was a member of the Anonymous group.
Wow. I didn't know that. That's interesting.
It's on the web, yeah.
Uh-huh. Was it because it was from Anonymous? They therefore didn't trust it? I mean,
I don't know. It may be.
Right.
But it shows the capability, if you focus and do a focus attack and
shows
a focus
you that the
on information.
Yeah. It shows you that the amateurs are doing a better job than the professionals. That's what
exactly.
It
says.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I sent a little note down to the blog in Washington blog, and they published it. I said we should hire Anonymous and fire the bums that we have.
Well, but the bums that we have, in spite of this huge haystack that they're building, they missed the Sinara brothers, they missed the 9/11.
They missed everything after 9/11, yeah.
And including 9/11, right?
Including 9/11.
Yeah. So is there any examples of, because I don't know whether you saw the Frontline piece on that Pakistani double agent responsible for the Mumbai terrorist attacks. The NSA took credit for it, when in fact it wasn't true. You know, they simply, you know.
Well, also look at Alexander claiming in Congress that he stopped 54 terrorist attacks using this program.
Right.
And how many did that end up? He ended up saying he had one. This guy who sent $8,500 to Al-Shabaab in Africa. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that means that one end is foreign in that transfer. That's not a domestic issue. So for the domestic portion of that program, it stopped zero terrorist attacks. But it was really great for FBI to put people in jail. You know, they used that data to find people, arrest them, and then they did a parallel construction to substitute information for them in the court of law. So they perjured themselves in a court of law to put people in jail. And that's really destroying our judicial system.
Right, but in terms of their own claims of success, none of them have panned out. That's what I...
Well, and you should take it, yeah, that's right. And if you looked at everything they've said in public in committees in Congress, they've been lying through their teeth all along.
So we pay more and more money for less and less success.
Right, it makes us all more vulnerable to attacks, right.
Right. What's going to break this cycle then? I mean, at least it sounds like the House is waking up.
Yes, the House is. The Senate is. I mean, the leadership, you see, the problem is the leadership, like McConnell and all in the Senate, they are already read into these programs, so they're a part of it, so they have to defend them, okay? So that's really why they're doing this. It's because they are culpable in the illegality and unconstitutional activity that's been going on.
Right.
That's their problem.
But once you're read in, it's like if you're in the Senate Intelligence or the House Intelligence Committee and you think something is really stupid that's going on or a waste of taxpayers' money, you can't say anything about it. So,
That's not true either. Well, Nancy Pelosi could have stopped this if she wanted to in the House. Even after the first briefing she got, even though they said you can't talk about it, she sort of simply said, either you stop this program or I'm going to introduce impeachment articles in the House against you. Now, that would have terminated that program.
I see.
Because it's obviously unconstitutional.
Well, but my understanding, though, is that being read in is a trap. In other words,
it is. If you agree to it, but if you've got a backbone and you say this is obviously unconstitutional, and I'm going to fulfill my oath of office, which is to defend and protect the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and you're domestic, by the way. So if I say that, and then I stand up in the House or the Senate, they have immunity there to do that, and they could issue articles of impeachment based on that, and they should have. But the only one who did anything about it was Dennis Kucinich. He read 35 articles of impeachment against George Bush before he left office.
And he was termed out. Gerrymandered out, I should
say. Well, Nancy Pelosi wouldn't allow it to come to the floor for the longest time. Right. For the longest time, she was saying impeaching George Bush is off the table. That's because she was read into these programs on the 4th of October of 2001. And she basically agreed to them and didn't say anything. So now she's culpable, so George could say to her, you know, hey, if you're going to impeach me, you have to impeach yourself, too, because you're a part of this. That's also true for McConnell.
Well, William Binney, I really appreciate you joining us here today.
Well, thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with William Binney, who served for 32 years in the National Security Agency and another 4 years in the military component of the NSA for a total of 37 years. He rose to the rank of the Technical Director of the World Geopolitical and Military Analysis and Reporting Group at the National Security Agency. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into assurances President Obama offered to nervous Saudi Arabian and Gulf state monarchs at Camp David. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Iranian-American historian Mazia Behrouz, who was born in Tehran and has taught at the University of California, Berkeley, and Stanford University, and is currently a professor of history at San Francisco State University. He's the author of two books on the history of the Iranian left that were translated into Persian and published in Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mazia Behrouz.
Thank you for having me.
And there's an interesting article in Thursday's New York Times by Andrew Bacevich about what's happening now and the extent to which both the Saudi king and the Israeli prime minister are ticked off with President Obama. And, of course, they're meeting the Saudis and the Gulf monarchs are all meeting at Camp David. But what Bacevich says in the article is that these nuclear negotiations with Iran are not really about nukes. The real aim of the talk is to end Iran's diplomatic isolation, which dates to the Carter-era hostage crisis, and bringing Iran in from the cold will alter the strategic landscape in ways that Israel and Saudi Arabia find discomforting. A completed deal will instantly transform Iran from a pariah into a major regional power. For existing regional powers, the result can mean only one thing: reduced room to maneuver. What's your impression of that analysis?
Well, I think the Iranian nuclear issue is an issue, but I agree that it is not the main issue. That is to say, I think it will be solved and it is solvable. I think the bigger issue is Iran's role in the region and Iran's support for its allies through which it has been able to project influence. I'm talking about in Lebanon through Hezbollah, in its friendship with the regime in Syria, and of course support among the Iraqi government and Iraqi population. And this has enabled for the first time these Shia minorities, or in the case of Iraq, where they were a majority but they were suppressed by a Sunni minority, to empower themselves. Actually, Iranian revolution since 1979 has empowered Shiism in the region. In the Arab world, Shias were always the underdog, and that has changed. And that, I think, is a big issue. And you can see it, I mean, Iran inspires them. That does not necessarily mean Iran is aiding them directly. But in the cases of Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon, of course, Iran is involved in training and providing support. But on a general note, I think that Iranian revolution has inspired Shias all around the world, which are, you know, a 10% minority among Muslims overall population. And this has made an impression upon traditional Sunni Muslim ruling classes. And I think that is the core of Iranian threat, not its military power necessarily, not its ability to gain nuclear weapons. All of those are concern. But I think the biggest concern is Iran's ability to project influence, Iran's ability to inspire large groups of people to rise up and stand for their rights in these different regions of the different areas of the region.
Well, but in Syria, Iran is propping up a despotic government that, when the people rose up and stood up for their rights, the Assad regime that Iran supports suppressed them and murdered them, and thus
Correct.
Began the civil war.
Correct. That is the case. Of course, Iran, as far as I can understand, was advising against such a tough reaction on the part of the Baath regime. But you must understand, Iran is a theocracy, and the Baath in Syria is a secular regime. And they do not really share ideologically anything ideological. Iran and Syria stood in a tactical union. Syria stood by Iran during the Iran-Iraq war. Iran stood by Syria in helping Hezbollah against Israel. But Iran and Syria do not really share or the Syrian Baath regime do not share ideological, they have nothing in common ideologically. Iran, as far as I can understand, actually advise against such violent reaction on the part of the state. But that is, you know, when people began to demonstrate back in 2011 against the Assad regime, the Assad regime reacted the way the Baath reacts everywhere, in Iraq, in Syria, everywhere, I mean, violently. The Baath ideology, very secular ideology, but using state violence to preserve itself and to maintain itself has been part of it since its establishment in both countries. So Iran, once the civil war started, had no choice but to stand behind the Syrian regime, and it has done so, and we see now the results that it's played an instrumental role in preventing it from collapse.
So on Wednesday, the president met in the White House with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Nayef and the Saudi Interior Minister and the Deputy Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the Defense Minister, who's the son of the king and supposedly in many ways he's only 29 years old, but he has a very powerful role. He's now taken over the oil ministry as well. Then on Thursday, President Obama offered Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states defense against missile attacks and maritime and cyber threats from Iran, trying to allay their fears about this nuclear deal with Tehran. But what's that good? Is that going to do, for example, to Saudi Arabia? When my understanding from what you've just talked about empowering Shias, the Shia minority in Saudi Arabia happened to be where the oil is, and no amount of assurances from the United States are going to change that. The only way for the Saudis to deal with the Shia minority is to deal with them correctly and not brutally. And my understanding is that they don't exactly have an enlightened approach.
Correct. Saudi Arabia has two groups of Shias, which are not related to each other. In the north, where the oil fields are, the Shias are related to Iran, so they are known as Twelver Shias. But in the south, on the Yemeni border, the Shia population is Zaydi Shia, which is the same as the Houthis across the border. Saudi Arabia is an autocratic and authoritarian regime. It is, like all authoritarian regimes, about control, and it is worried about its substantial Shia population, which does not share its creed of Islam and its ideological standing. Saudi Arabia, furthermore, is worried beyond its borders about Shia activities. In Bahrain, it intervened 2 years ago. In Yemen, it is intervening now. And, of course, both under the pretext of Iranian influence. But really, both in Bahrain and in Yemen, there are a lot of internal issues going on. And the Saudis, in effect, under the pretext of fighting Iran, are trying to make a difference in these internal struggles. In Bahrain, they were successful, and in Yemen, they have intervened. It is an ongoing issue. There is a state meltdown, and I doubt that this type of bombings and aerial activity can make a big difference in this, what is actually a civil war in Yemen.
But do you think that the Saudis are trying to bait the Iranians into some kind of response in Yemen? Because they keep making this assumption, and a lot of American analysts...
I doubt it. Because for a very simple reason, because Iran doesn't have the capability to do much more than it's done right now.
Right, but I'm saying that the Iranians are being very cautious from what I can tell.
They're very cautious because they can't do anything else. You know, Iran is overstretched. It is under international sanctions. Its economy is not doing well, and it has put all its resources in trying to make a difference in Syria and Iraq and the Kurdish region of Iraq. Iran is helping all three to fight ISIS. And this Yemen issue is something that Iran did not really welcome. And it happened despite Iran's, wanting it to happen. Iran is what is happening in Yemen is really an internal meltdown. Different groups fighting each other. There are some who are Zaydi Shias in Yemen who are fighting against the Houthis. Remember, Houthis are a movement within this Shia Zaydi population of Yemen. There are Zaydis who are fighting against the Houthis. There are Sunnis who are fighting alongside Houthis against Al-Qaeda, against the other Sunnis. So the situation in Yemen is pretty complicated, and and it's very much internal. I think that the dragging Iran into this is something obviously Iran doesn't want. And but on the other hand, it is very difficult for Iran to just say nothing as Saudi Arabia freely bombs Yemeni cities and the international community is basically standing by and doing nothing. I mean, after all, what we have here is six Arab countries attacking another Arab country. These are all members of United Nations. Six members of United Nations have attacked another member of United Nations, and nobody is saying anything.
Well, but the consequences of Wahhabism are horrendous when you add up. Think about all of how close they are ideologically and theocratically to the Islamic State, Al Qaeda, Al Shabaab, and even Boko Haram in Nigeria. And then you also have. You can see what Saudi influence has done in Pakistan, going back to they created the Taliban. I mean, arguably, the Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia are the Taliban with oil. And you've got the Shia massacres that go on regularly inside of Pakistan. Much of this is being traced to Saudi Wahhabism, to the point even now where the Pakistan government is starting to get leery. And I noticed the Pakistanis did not join the Saudis in being invited in to help them out in Yemen.
I agree with you. I mean, another example of what, where you can trace this, all of this being rooted in Saudi interpretation of Islam, which we commonly call Wahhabism, is this enmity these movements have with history and how they destroy historical sites and historical representation of that civilization from the Buddhas in Bamiyan in Afghanistan to destroying the artifacts in Kabul National Museum when the Taliban were in charge of Kabul back in 1990s, to what is happening in northern Iraq and Syria, yes, as we talk, and compare that to what the Saudis did in Mecca and Medina, where all these historical monuments, structures, which had been preserved since the beginning of Islam, have been destroyed by the Saudis as symbols of sinful worshipping, seeing partnership to God, and which is all in accordance with Wahhabism's creed or brand of interpretation of Islam, which, as I mentioned, is pretty intolerant.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate your time, Dr. Mazia Barouz.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Mazia Barouz, who's an Iranian-American historian who was born in Tehran and has taught at the University of California, Berkeley, and Stanford University. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.